President Nixon addresses students on the campus of Kansas State University and appeals for order. But a few hecklers demonstrate the potential for disorder. A NewsFront special report on the outlook on the nation's campuses.
NewsFront is supported in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Good evening, I'm Mitchell Krause. Tonight on NewsFront, New York Times Education Authority Fred Hechinger previews the year on the American campus. Then a look at the prospect for East-West trade relations as we talk with international lawyer Samuel Pizar, author of Coexistence and Commerce. But first, for a summary of the day's news, here's Bernard Eisman.
Good evening. Jordan is gripped in what can only be described as a civil war tonight, with government forces doing battle with Palestinian guerrillas. The Jordanian capital of Amman is now the scene of continuous fighting between the two groups. The guerrillas are openly calling for the overthrow of Jordan's King Hussein. Hussein brought the crisis to a boil yesterday by installing a new government that imposed military rule on Jordan and threatened to crush guerrilla insurgents with an iron fist. Today, two communist Arab countries, Iraq and Syria, pledged their aid to the guerrillas, with Iraq saying that guerrilla chief Yasser Arafat has its troops at his disposal. The guerrillas' Baghdad-based radio station called on the Jordanian people to arise and overthrow the fascist regime of King Hussein. More than half of Jordan's people are former Palestinians, most of them living in refugee camps along the Israeli lines. The crisis in Jordan has made even more uncertain the fate of those 54 airline hostages still being held by the guerrillas. Reports from Amman tonight say Arab terrorists have kept the hostages in groups of three and are moving them from hiding place to hiding place. There was no indication today that any movement had been made to secure the release of the 54, 36 of them Americans, and the majority of those Jews. Israel's Premier Golda Meir arrived in the United States today. She'll meet with President Nixon Friday. Mrs. Meir denied allegations made earlier today by State Department spokesman that Israel had violated the ceasefire by flying a reconnaissance plane over Egyptian territory. The charge was made by the U.S. today, which earlier took 2 weeks after Israel had offered evidence of Egyptian violations to confirm the movement of SAM-3 missiles in the Canal Truce Zone. President Nixon today was heckled by 40 or 50 students, but given an overwhelming ovation by 15,000 students, faculties, and friends, as he took a hard line against those who he said reject the rules of civilized conduct. Violence and terror, said Nixon, have no place in a free society, whoever the perpetrators and whatever their cause. In his speech, the president said that only the universities, their students, faculty, and administrators can save higher education in America.
The number of students in college today has doubled in the past 10 years. But at a time when the quality of education is going dramatically up, its quality is massively threatened by assaults which terrorize faculty, students, and university and college administrators alike. And it is time for the responsible university and college administrators, faculty, and student leaders to stand up and be counted.
The president spoke at Kansas State University at Manhattan, Kansas. The vice president was still on the political road today, characterizing hecklers who greeted him as pathetic and calling Democratic Senator Philip Hart of Michigan a radical liberal. Met at the airport at Grand Rapids by supporters as well as opponents, Agnew invoked the patriotism of the working man in the appeal for Republican votes. Agnew shouted at the hecklers, "I've listened to your four-letter arguments and I'm not persuaded. You preach a lot about dissent," he said, "but you are afraid of other points of view." To the crowd, Agnew said, "The dissident elements, the carpers, the complainers, the runners down will not run this country." Agnew was speaking in support of the candidacy of GOP senatorial hopeful Mrs. Lenore Romney. Police in Grand Rapids say they arrested a man who threatened Agnew's life. Serious bargaining in the General Motors UAW strike isn't expected to begin again until next week. Tomorrow, union leaders start a tour of 25 cities to lend support to striking workers. In Detroit today, UAW President Leonard Woodcock said he couldn't predict how long the strike against GM would last, but did say there are no ideological hang-ups, so there's no reason for for it to last too long. With GM's truck, Ford today announced an increase in the price of its 1971 cars. The average boost on Ford cars, $153. That's the biggest raise in 5 years. Mitchell?
This week, as President Nixon noted in his Manhattan, Kansas speech today, marks the beginning of another week and year on the nation's campuses. What's the outlook? Violence, agitation, or the peaceful pursuit of studies? The view of one who specializes in this ever more newsworthy area of concern. He is Fred Hechinger, a member of the editorial board of the New York Times, and that paper's former education editor. Mr. Hechinger, if you had to rate this coming academic year on a passion scale, as you would find it in an amusement park, how would you compare it to other years that we've seen dawn?
Well, I'd say that it's probably the most worried in terms of passion, the most worried opening of the campuses, although nobody really knows what is going to happen. I think generally there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty. People are trying to tell themselves, the administrators particularly, that it really can't be as bad as it was last year, but they're not convinced. I think generally it's a very fearful year.
Now, this fear, is this related directly to what is known about organization of student groups, or is it a fear of a kind of unstructured, anarchistic, nihilistic violence?
I think it's mainly the latter. It's, of course, the in a sense, the Wisconsin bombing has really shocked everybody to a point where there is this feeling that the unpredictable is much, much more difficult to deal with. Last year, as you know, was a terribly rough year on many campuses. There was a lot of window smashing and minor fighting. And then, of course, there was the there were the terrible incidents of Kent State and Jackson. But it was all the kind of thing that was on the surface. And now there's, of course, tremendous concern about what do you do if the radically underground continues to resort to the kind of things that happened in Wisconsin. Now, at the same time, because this is so, you have intensive preparations this year, much more so than any year that I can remember, for campus security. Whether that will make things calmer than they've been in the past, or whether that in itself will also provoke additional action, nobody can tell at this point.
Of course, 2 years ago, and even before that, we had the manifesto of the students of one sort or another making specific demands. Do we have a similar set of circumstances this
year? I would
say
right now, no. The only thing that we have in a kind of a vague way, the National Student Association, after fairly narrowly voting against any kind of violent action, then said that it was setting May 1st as the deadline for the United States to be out of the war.
And May 1st, 1971.
71. And that implies that if by that time that demand is not met, there might be some less nonviolent action. And this in itself, I think, raises a question. The last few years really have fallen apart just about that time, April, May. And there's a great temptation to make the spring the revolutionary period because the work is pretty much completed. And so there's concern about that kind of deadline. Yes. On other issues, there aren't any specific demands at this point.
Well, have any of the demands that were made really been met? Are the campuses and the management of the universities any different really now than they were 2 or 3 years ago?
I'd say in terms, if you talk about the educational demands, I think very little has happened. My personal feeling is that from that point of view, if anything, the campuses today are worse than they were then.
This relates to curriculum.
To what people do on the campus. The very fact that there has been this escalating fear and suspicion has, in a sense, made the academic scene less satisfactory. People are more worried about being disrupted in their research and what they do. The demands for the abandoning of obsolete requirements in many places has led simply to the abandonment of all requirements with very little of a sense of what should be substituted.
Kind of open admissions, almost.
But on open admission, I'm glad you bring this up, I think on that score, which is, of course, very directly related to a very important demand, which is to get more minority students into the campuses, I think there great gains have been made, not only through open admission, but through the general admissions process. I think there tremendous improvement has been.
What about the role of the university in the community and its extracurricular activities, so to speak, in terms of government research and the like?
I would say that in general, well, of course, in terms of government research, two things have happened. First of all, the government has withdrawn a lot of research simply because of the budget cutting. Also the budget cutting. And that has been a very serious problem for the universities because much of the unrestricted research has been financed by the government. There's also, of course, a withdrawing of research that for reasons of protests, war research, classified research. I happen to think that it's a good thing to get classified research off the campus. I think in that respect there have been gains. But there hasn't been much of a substitute of other kind of work. So in from that point of view, things I think are worse. There hasn't been terribly much substituted in new forms of research, although we are moving in many places. The campuses are moving toward more work on the pollution problem and that kind of thing. But in general, I would say the relationship between the community at large in the universities today is much worse than it was. And I think because of that, the universities, if anything, are less influential than they were, say, 5 or 10 years ago.
Yes. What about the administration of the universities?
Hasn't changed a terrible lot. I start out by saying that many more students are involved in specific committees, particularly in terms of discipline and so forth, but also
been democratized.
Students have been added almost everywhere. Many trustees' boards have been rejuvenated. Take the example at Princeton, for instance, which is not unique, but at Princeton, each senior class now votes for 2 new members out of the senior class to join the trustees after graduation. Now that means a constant influx of younger people who have recent contact with the campus onto the governing board, and I think that's in general is an improvement, great improvement. There is certainly more responsiveness on the part of administrations, but if you look for a really dramatic change in administration because students have been added, I would say no, just doesn't work that way.
What has all this done to the traditional sources of funds for universities? Has this affected them severely?
Well, in terms of the immediate contributions by alumni, most of the private institutions say that they have not directly been hurt by the unrest, although it really is much too early to tell. In terms of the general financial situation, the universities are in the worst disaster situation they've been in as long as I can remember. First of all, of course, with the economy and with the stock market as it is, quite naturally large-scale giving is affected. But also, again, with the government contracts. See, most private universities have had a major part of their budget coming out of government contracts. Many of them, half of their budget. So that you are now dealing almost across the board with huge deficits. Columbia has just announced an $11 million deficit for last year. Princeton is in the $2 million area.
How will this affect the student?
Well, I think it will affect the student in that there'll be a cutback in the offerings eventually, not immediately, because right now the staff cutbacks are largely on the non-faculty staff side, the housekeeping staff. But eventually, there's no question that there'll be fewer offerings. There may be, another effect may be that the faculty will have to spend more time in the classroom for the same amount of pay. That, to some extent, this might help the student. The student might have more contact with the faculty. But generally, I think there's going to be a retrenchment, and I think it's generally true that if an institution is in poor financial shape, it's reflected in the amount of freedom it can grant, it's reflected in its general way of life, and if it's a marginal institution, it may very well be faced by the question of whether it will either close down or become public.
So if you combine this fear and the fund shortage and general atmosphere you've indicated, you have a very bleak picture, don't you?
I'd say it's a very bleak picture, and it's a bleak picture also because many of the state legislatures are involved in the backlash. This is a good time for them to cut back anyway, because there's taxpayer revolt every place. But in addition to that, they say, look, we are less interested in this venture because of the unrest. So generally, I think it's a very unpleasant year to start.
Are there any specific institutions that you see as being places to watch this fall or this coming year?
That's very hard to predict, because, of course, predicting in itself is sort of it's a dangerous thing, because you then seem to be creating trouble. But generally, the picture in the past has been that the high-prestige universities are in greater danger because they're more visible. The important public institutions, such as in the past Berkeley last year, as unlikely a place as Ohio State. It's an important, large institution, but generally used to be a very placid and conservative one, and yet it had a great deal of trouble. So I don't think you can predict where it will occur, but generally I think it's fair to look at the high prestige and visible institutions.
Well, thank you very much, Fred Hechinger.
Thank you. I enjoyed being with you.
Also in the budget of today's news was official confirmation that President Nixon would include Yugoslavia in the itinerary of his forthcoming visit to Europe. You remember that last year he visited communist Romania. A reminder, perhaps, that East and West continue to move a bit closer in political as well as economic relations. This fruitful area is the subject covered by our next guest. He is Samuel Pizar, a prominent international lawyer who resides in Europe. Pizar, who served as a member of President Kennedy's Task Force on Foreign Economic Policy, is the author of the newly published book, Coexistence and Commerce, Guidelines for Transactions Between East and West. Mr. Pizar, I know you've just arrived from Europe, and we noted in the press today that in addition to the president referring to his stopover in Yugoslavia, that the Soviet Union and Spain were exchanging economic delegations. What do these two developments perhaps show you about changes in the East-West situation?
I think it's an excellent thing that the president is going to Yugoslavia. What it means to me is that he's probably trying to symbolize the fact that Yugoslavia does not belong to the Eastern Bloc. It belongs to the world. The president went to Romania last year. That served to emphasize that Romania is a citizen of the world, not necessarily within the confines of the Brezhnev doctrine. As far as Spain is concerned, that has an interest of its own. I think it proves that ideologies are breaking down. Franco-Spain thinks nothing of exchanging delegations with communist countries. The communist countries think nothing of dealing with Franco-Spain. There are examples of this, and I deal with some of them in my book. For example, last year, the French Communist Party was torn asunder by the fact that communist Poland was selling coal to Franco-Spain while the Asturian coal miners were on strike. Very disturbing, because a communist country was, as it were, helping a quasi-fascist government in a country where the communist, socialist, proletarian coal miners were on strike.
Apparently, ideology is not affecting President Nixon, because he will visit Franco himself in Spain in his forthcoming trip.
I suppose this is intended to keep a balance. You visit Franco, you visit Yugoslavia.
Would you
describe that?
Yes. Do you see then really what you're saying is that the ideology in all of these situations, whether they are in the United States camp or in the Soviet camp, really are not the important aspects of a given situation. That underlying it is economics?
I think ideology is giving way, and it is giving way to pragmatism. The communist bloc is no longer as monolithic as it used to be a few years ago. If you look at the Soviet Union and China, the abuse they heap on each other, even the armed conflicts that take place occasionally, the Usuri River, the Xinjiang province. If you look at Romania, if you look at Yugoslavia, you cannot really say that there is one communist bloc that's broken down. The same is true in the West. The United States, Gaullist France, post-Gaullist France, it's no longer the same closely knit alliance.
Well, are you one of those who, like so many of the students of Middle Eastern economics, will say that behind every political move is really an economic factor, such as oil in the Middle East, that there are no real political conflicts anymore?
I think there used to be. The communist countries were very forcefully following their ideology, particularly in the days of Stalin and shortly thereafter. I think when John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State in the United States, there was also a strong polarization. But with the years, this has broken down, and today economics are coming to the forefront. People are sick and tired of ideology. They want pragmatic contacts. They want progress.
Now, your book deals largely with the mechanics. A great deal of your book deals with the mechanics of developing these economic relations between East and West, between the communist bloc and the capitalist bloc. What are the basic problems outside of the political hang-ups in developing these negotiations and these relationships?
I have tried to stay away from the flamboyant aspects of the problem. There are some emotional problems in the entire thing. But I'm concerned, as you say, with many of the practical problems, because to construct a basis for mutually profitable, advantageous economic relations between East and West, the present framework that exists for trade has to be modified. It is very different for an American company, for example, to trade with an Eastern country such as Czechoslovakia, East Germany, or even Yugoslavia than to trade with France, Germany, and Holland. In what way? On one side, in Western Europe, you are dealing really with free economy, with an individual firm. In the East, every time you build any transaction, you're always dealing with the state itself. The state is the only buyer, the only seller, the only insurer, the only banker, and so forth.
The competition that you would expect then in a freer economy does not exist in this kind of situation.
There is no competition at all in a communist economy. The state is behind everything. The state procures on a massive basis whatever it chooses to procure. It is, by definition, a highly protectionist economy. Yugoslavia, you mentioned it, it's different. In fact, as you asked me the question, I was wondering whether Yugoslavia is really within the Eastern Bloc. I deal with this particular subject in my book.
Yes, you mentioned that Sweden we take for granted, but Sweden and Yugoslavia both have very similar systems.
They have very similar systems, and Yugoslavia is highly significant because it started out being a communist economy, then Tito had his famous rupture with Stalin, and gradually they decentralized, they allowed cooperatives, they even allowed a certain amount of competition in their economy. And in economic terms, I would not classified today, Yugoslavia with Russia, or with Czechoslovakia, or with East Germany. And this is highly significant because Yugoslavia is having a diffusive influence on the smaller Eastern European countries. They are afraid of Russia, of course. They cannot go too far afield, but they are tending towards the Yugoslav model.
Well, earlier we talked about the non-competitive aspect of the situation within the communist bloc for American or Western businessmen. Yet the Ford Motor Company was about to go ahead with a
deal inside the Soviet Union, and this deal died. Was this because of the Soviet Union or because of the American government?
I think it was because of the American government. Mr. Henry Ford was invited to the Soviet Union to take a look at the possibility of building a very large truck plant. When he returned to the United States, he was greeted by a virtual veto delivered to the press by Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird, on the ground that some of these trucks might one day find their way to the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Mind you, the entire project could not have possibly brought one truck off the assembly line until 1975. Inconceivable, I submit to you, that the United States would still have military involvement in Vietnam at that time. But this was the reason for the veto. Now, the thing is of great fascination because think of the significance in terms of the East-West ideological confrontation. For the Soviet Union to invite Henry Ford, who is the epitome of American capitalism and patriotism, to come and build a highly modern plant in the heart of communist Russia. What greater admission of the failure of communism can you have? Now, Henry Ford was not allowed to do it, yet our allies, Germany and France, Daimler-Benz that produces the Mercedes car and Renault of France, are falling over one another in an effort to do that deal, and they are evidently signing contracts and will probably get the possibility of drawing considerable profits out of the transaction.
Well, that Ford deal, of course, amazed everyone when it was first announced that the Soviet Union would invite the Ford Motor Company. Why not go to other companies in Europe and not have to face that kind of situation that you implied? Why did they do that?
I don't think the Europeans have the same kind of capacity. What the Russians really need in the vast snows and spaces of Siberia, central Russia, is Ford trucks and Ford cars. They couldn't buy from the United States. They settled a few years ago on Fiat of Italy. But if you look at the expanse of Russia, what Russia really needs is Fords.
Pizar, in our final moments, let's get back to that question of economics versus politics. Has then the Cold War, per se, or the competition between East and West shifted to the economic arena? Is this where the eventual victory or defeat of these two systems will come?
I will put it to you quite bluntly. The thesis of my book, Coexistence and Commerce, is that the strongest weapon the West has in its historic contest with communism is not its expensive and far-flung military establishment, but its capacity for economic progress, its superior capacity for economic progress. It is this superior capacity, I think, that will help us to prevail. This is the tender sword that will peacefully conquer the frozen East and bring to the East technology, a consumer society, and ultimately, I believe, all the human freedoms that go with it.
And this does not necessarily mean that the East must capitulate to the West in this regard.
On the contrary, the East cannot capitulate, cannot be required to capitulate, because the East is as strong or almost as strong as the West. Any atomic confrontation is inconceivable, and I proceed from the premise that both types of societies will continue into the indefinite future. They will adjust to each other. They will converge at some point, but they will not knock each other off.
Mr. Samuel Pizar, thank you for what turns out to be a somewhat optimistic view of at least one aspect of the world today.
Thank you.
Tomorrow evening here on Newsfront, we'll be talking to the new president of the United Nations General Assembly, Edvard Hambro. That's tomorrow night here on Newsfront when we continue to cover the breaking developments in that aspect of the world's story. We'll also later in the week cover such interesting subjects as the latest in the Southeast Asian and Middle Eastern situations. Newsfront, produced in New York by WNDT, is brought to you through the facilities of the Eastern Educational Television Network.
Newsfront is supported in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Now, Newsfront, Part 2. The community comes to the aid of a Marine accused of rape. Sherry Henry will report. And Emily Jenauer interviews Jack Burnham, professor of art at Northwestern University. First, for a summary of some late local area news, here again is Bernard Eisenman.
Governor Nelson Rockefeller spent a good part of today backpedaling away from some embarrassing political remarks. At a dinner meeting with leading black businessmen last night, the governor, running for re-election, said he was sorry he wasn't running with Basil Patterson, who is black and who is the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor. Rockefeller also said that the reason the GOP didn't slate a black man in the controller's position was because the Republican candidate is sure to lose. Arthur Levitt, the Democratic incumbent, said Rockefeller was in like Flynn. After his remarks, the governor and his aides tried to convince newsmen not to report what was said, to consider the remarks off the record. Most did not, since no such precondition was laid down in advance. Today, Governor Rockefeller issued a formal statement heaping praise upon his own GOP running mates, all of them, and claimed that if the Republican ticket deserves to win in November and can win. During Long Island today, the governor refused to engage in any conversation about his political gaffe of last night. Mayor Lindsay was in Washington today telling the federal government what it didn't know about nose counting in the big city. Lindsay cited what he called grossly inaccurate census data that resulted from poor mail distribution, untrained and poorly paid census takers, a lack of Spanish language forms, and a lack of knowledge on the part of census officials of how life is in the poverty areas of big cities. Lindsay has maintained that a short count shows New York City to have 500,000 people less than it really has. Lindsay also suggested that a census be taken every 5 years instead of every 10 as it is now. Mitchell?
Thank you, Bernard. Every so often, a particular legal case comes to the attention of the media and then to the community. This is true of tonight's next story, the tale of a 20-year-old Marine Lance Corporal named Ronald V. Johnson. Corporal Johnson, a native of Brooklyn, was court-martialed and judged guilty on a charge of raping an Okinawan girl in 1968. Now the case is up for retrial, and community leaders and others have organized to help the Marine, whom they feel to be innocent, in the preparation of his defense. A look at that case now as reporter Sherry Henry talks with Thomas Cleveland, managing attorney for the defense, and he is with the Bedford-Stuyvesant Legal Services Corporation. He is Corporal Johnson's civil attorney in the coming retrial. Francis X. Smith, former president of the New York City Council, a former district attorney, and a practicing New York lawyer. And Richard Oliver, a reporter for the New York Daily News, and a man instrumental through his investigative reporting of opening the way to a retrial. Sherry?
Mr. Oliver, you followed this case all along. As a matter of fact, you are responsible for a lot of the evidence in it. Can you give us a quick background, a look of the case as a whole?
Sure, Sherry. Case came to my attention about a year ago. Young Lance Corporal Johnson was found guilty on the evidence of a Okinawan girl who identified him and the testimony of a white Marine. Unfortunately, racism enters into this case. In a little more than a day, he was found guilty and sentenced to of rape and sentenced to 12 years in prison. The sentence was later reduced to 5 years. About a year after he had entered prison, Lance Corporal Johnson's mother sent out an appeal to the news media around the city and the nation and asked for somebody to please come and look at some evidence that she had. This letter, by the way, came to the president of the Daily News and it was passed down the command, and I got it just when I started at the news. And I called her and she came in, and sure enough, something didn't sound right in the case. There was a fellow, a clean-cut white sergeant, who was willing to say and testify and swear that this girl told him that Lance Corporal Johnson didn't do it. There was absolutely no reason why this man should lie, so this led on to other leads. She also had an affidavit from another young Marine, a white Marine, who testified that he was part of a plot that as a result of racial problems on Okinawa, there was a plot to frame Johnson. I, after going to and consulting with Mr. Cleveland, and after visiting Washington, discussing the case with all of the parties, wrote a story saying that there's a possibility of a conspiracy that has put this man into prison. Sure enough, it appeared in the Daily News on page 2. 2 days later, a physician appeared, a physician who lives on Long Island, and who said, by God, this girl was brought to me. Was brought to me on the day of the alleged rape. This girl refused to be medically examined, refused to say she had been raped. The whole thing didn't sound as though the girl had been raped. And she, in fact, told me that she had just had an abortion. Well,
but
I believe this
but
was
Mr. Oliver, surely during the trial, they brought out some evidence that the girl was examined by a doctor. She was claiming rape.
They brought out evidence that she went to a doctor and that she refused to be examined because she was embarrassed that it was her menstrual period and that she refused to be examined. This is in the record.
Well, Mr. Cleveland, you're the attorney now for Corporal Johnson. You were not the attorney then, were you?
No.
Who was defending him then?
He had a young lawyer who was a reservist from Minnesota, I think.
Who was supplied by the military?
By the military.
Wasn't he asking for civil defense at the time? Didn't he want that for his case?
He sure did. He sure did. He wrote his family. And the lawyer, the civilian lawyer on Okinawa, requested a retainer of $1,000 to take the case. Family being of little means was unable to raise such a high sum.
Mr. Smith, you've defended Marines before. You're familiar with military justice. Why is it that the military doesn't provide a civil lawyer, if requested, as we do in the States, if there's an indigent party?
Well, at the present time, we are defending Corporal Johnson as civil attorneys. But I think we should recognize the fact that there is such a great need for a complete reform of the Military Code of Justice. And Congressman Hugh Carey from Brooklyn is introducing a resolution into Congress which will provide civilian attorneys when a member of the military is accused of a crime to give them the same protection and to treat them not as second-class citizens, but as first-class citizens. And the firm that I am coming in with, Jacob Fuchsberg and Judge Sam Leibowitz, are proceeding on the principle in this case that Corporal Johnson has the same legal rights and is entitled to the same legal defense as a five-star general.
But, Mr. Smith, you're doing that out of the goodness of your and the law firm's heart, I assume. What if you didn't rise to the occasion? What if any Marine abroad is brought in front of a court? And
there's
needs
no
a civil
provision
lawyer?
In law at this point for civilian counsel unless it's at the defendant's expense.
Well, I think an incident that took place only last week emphasizes the need for a complete review of the Code of Military Justice. As you have just heard, Corporal Johnson is now facing a retrial in a case which, to me, was so strange. I don't think there was adequate preparation for his defense. From the record, I have learned that the attorneys assigned to him did not come into the case until the day before the trial, could not have prepared a defense properly. And only last week, we received a telegram from his assigned counsel on Okinawa, asking us again to waive his rights and to stand in a lineup 2 years after he has been convicted of a crime. We immediately wired back that we refused to waive any rights that he has and demanded that we be present, because I think this is a very, very dangerous situation where 2 years after a man has been exposed to a trial, now being compelled to stand in a lineup. I don't think anybody who looks at this case could have any doubt but that he can be identified after being viewed in court and viewed on the premises where he has been returned.
This last 2 years has been spent in jail, hasn't it?
That's correct.
Even though he has been granted a second court-martial, has he still been in jail during this time?
That was a fight in itself. He was granted the second court-martial on April 1st, last April 1st. It was a fight to get him out of jail. This is the first time the military itself has ever, ever overturned a conviction.
I think, again, to attorneys throughout the entire world, it will come as a shock to realize that people charged with any crime in the United States are entitled to bail. And yet, a man in the military charged with any crime is not entitled to bail. We think this, too, cries out for reform and revision.
Back to what you said just a minute ago, that this is the very first second court-martial that has ever been granted. Is that true?
This is the very first time that the military has... Right. This is the very first time they've overturned
the case.
Isn't
there an incredible
number? The civil
number
courts have. There are 100,000, 110,000 court-martials a year. This will give you some idea of the importance of this case.
Well, is there a system of appeal from a court-martial?
There sure is, and he went all the way and then some. Mr. Cleveland and I went to Portland, Maine, when he tried to get into the federal system through a writ of habeas corpus. We were thrown out, and he was told to go back into the military appeal system.
What are you saying to my layman's ear, that he had no appeal into our civil courts? Domestic courts, is that right, that he had to stay within the military?
He does, and as every American citizen has a right to a writ of habeas corpus. The traditional view of the federal courts is to return a case to the military for proper process in the military courts. The military courts are reluctant to overturn their own convictions.
Well, Mr. Smith, you're talking about what's fair and what isn't fair in the military system. Does this strike you as a portion of the law that ought to be changed?
Yes, it does, and I think this particular case is one that is going to result in a complete revision of the military code of justice. This is going to be a landmark case, I think, and not only for the military, but also for civilian law. And I can't praise too highly the work that was done by Mr. Oliver in this case. Without his devotion and complete dedication to digging up the facts, Corporal Johnson would still be in jail today.
I think we ought to go back to that, Mr. Oliver,
sure,
and talk about the fact that you did get a second court-martial because of new evidence which you dug up, which was what?
The evidence really existed. Part of it existed. Part of it the mother was aware of. But Mr. Cleveland had so much trouble in getting it before a tribunal. I firmly believe, that the publicity given, I think Mr. Cleveland will back me on this, eased it into the before a tribunal. A special three-man panel was set up to review the evidence. In addition, I think that the publicity generated interest and also brought forward this doctor I spoke of, who did not appear at the first court-martial. Can you imagine a rape case, and the girl was taken to a doctor, and the doctor was not called?
He was not called as
a
witness there.
He was shipped out of
Okinawa.
Not
even by the defense.
He was shipped out of Okinawa prior to the court-martial.
Mr. Cleveland, you are going to Okinawa for this case, and Mr. Smith is going along, and other members of the law firm. What ever happened to Miss Cokie? Isn't that her name, the girl who was allegedly raped?
Well, first you see Miss Cokie and then you don't. At times they have her disappearing, they can't find her. I get a telegram she's lost, and again they have found her. Now presently she's still in Okinawa. I don't think she's working at the mess hall as a waitress any longer. There's one point I'd like to go point out that Mr. Oliver just mentioned. Now, in the United States Navy, we have only two, at the time of the new trial, there are only two Negro or black lawyers. They had one sitting on the three-man panel, and the other one was prosecuting the case, saying we did not need a new trial, there would be redundancy, and we should have found this newly discovered evidence at the time of the original trial.
Are you saying there's racial discrimination in reverse?
Definitely.
Mr. Oliver, now, what's the chance on the new trial? Actually, will it come to trial? Are you expecting this to actually take place?
I think that the military is so concerned about this case, as Frank Smith can tell you. Both of I went down to talk to military authorities last Friday to Washington, and it's amazing. The brass all the way up is aware of this case, and I think it will come to trial. Of course, it could. The charges could be dropped, but I'm convinced it will come to trial.
Well, Mr. Smith, I take it that you're in this case because you feel that regardless of the man's guilt or innocence, there's a system of military justice here that ought to be looked at. Is that right?
Well, I very frankly say to you tonight that I have no doubt that Corporal Johnson is innocent. We are seeking justice in this case, as we do in all cases. And certain motions are going to be made asking for a dismissal of the charges against Corporal Johnson. Certain other steps will be taken to ensure that everything humanly possible will be done to ensure that Corporal Johnson receives a fair trial. I am amazed at the buck passing that has taken place within the past week. It seems that none of the authorities, either in the Navy or the Marine Corps, have any jurisdiction over this case. They've referred us to the commanding general at Camp Butler on Okinawa. I assure you that every right that Corporal Johnson has will be protected, and we'll do everything we can to see that justice is done in this case.
It's rather appropriate to see you going back to Okinawa since you were the commander who took Sugarloaf Hill there. Is that right?
Well, I'm going back with mixed emotions, but I am sure that there'll be pride in our hearts when we do return with Corporal Johnson acquitted of any charges.
There seems to be a good deal of pride in Bedford-Stuyvesant right now, isn't there, Mr. Cleveland? Hasn't there been some sort of a community feeling about this man and his
problem? Oh,
definitely,
definitely. There is, in fact, a fund. I should say this first. Organization I work for, Bedford-Stuyvesant Legal Services, there's no provision in federal law for a defense of a case of this type. In fact, I'm doing it on my own time and at my own expense, except for funds which are coming into the Lance Corporal Johnson Defense Fund at 1170 Fulton Street, Brooklyn.
Mr. Cleveland, that's a major effort on your part. Mr. Oliver, let me ask you in our closing moments, if it had not been for an interested reporter who took it upon himself to dig a little deeper than the average case, would any of this come to light? Where would this man be now?
I have no doubt that he'd be sitting in a cell at Portsmouth Naval Prison. I have no doubt at all. The thing that worries me is that there may be out there more cases like this. This is the thing that troubles me, and I think that by bringing this case to light, that we might be able to bring to light other cases.
Mr. Oliver, Mr. Cleveland, Mr. Smith, thank you for coming to Newsfront tonight to tell us about a very important legal case.
Now Newsfront covers the arts. Here's critic Emily Genauer with guest and a look at the latest at the Jewish Museum.
The first big new museum exhibition of the New York art season opens tonight at the Jewish Museum, located at 1109 Fifth Avenue. Now, exhibitions at the Jewish Museum practically never have anything to do with Jewish art. The question is whether the new exhibition called Software has anything to do with any kind of art. Software, as I understand it, refers to the programs, processes, and sensibilities inherent in and created by the vastly complicated electronic devices of our computer and communications technology. They are presumed to have aesthetic significance because they were devised by artists. Now, hardware, I take it, would refer to any tangible objects that might result from computer programs and processes. If I'm wrong about this, our guest this evening, Jack Burnham, who is a professor of art at Northwestern University and served as curator of the new museum exhibition, will set us straight. But first, here are some film clips of two of the exhibits in the new show. One by an artist called John Baldessari is called Art Cremation. Baldessari decided that he wanted to rid his life of his accumulated art, and here you see him doing it. And here is his own description of what he's about. With this project, I will have all my accumulated paintings cremated by a mortuary. The container of ashes will be interred inside a wall of the Jewish Museum. For the length of the show, there will be a commemorative plaque on the wall behind which the ashes are located. Will a phoenix arise from the ashes? Will the paintings, having become dust, become art materials again? I don't know, says Mr. Baldessari, but I feel better. Well, I'm glad he feels better. I might feel better, too, if I were familiar with the pictures he destroyed. But I'm not. And my first reaction to a picture burning is to feel even worse than I would to a book burning. And that's an association I'm especially unhappy to feel within the walls of the Jewish Museum. Now for the second clip. This one shows a work in the exhibition called Seek, devised by Nicholas Necroponte, a professor at MIT. In it, 40 small gerbils, very like mice, run around a 5-by-8-foot surface among hundreds of 2-inch plastic cubes. They're surrounded by electromagnets, which measure how the animals respond to the blocks as they collide with them. An electronic grasper overhead shifts the blocks into new arrangements, which will keep the gerbils walled in. The point of Seek, I gather, is to see if computers can be made more responsive to the changing, unpredictable needs of men as well as mice. Now, Mr. Burnham, can you tell us whether you think Baldessari's art cremation piece and Negroponte's Seek are works of art, or whether they're in any way related to an art experience, and whether, therefore, they belong in a museum exhibition?
Well, to begin, I think very much that Baldessari is making a statement as an artist. And the significant thing about it is that he's using his own paintings. He's not destroying anybody else's paintings, but he's using new media to transcribe and produce the feelings that he had in the, because of and through the destruction. What I mean by that is maybe he felt he was at an impasse as an artist, and painting no longer served his needs. So he actually makes a work of art out of the movies, the film clips, the photographs that we see here tonight.
Which will record, you mean, for the large audience, his feelings about destruction of his works of art.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I think as long as they're his works, he's entitled to it.
The commuter technology, or the technology aspect of it, comes in the fact that we're seeing films of this in the exhibition.
Yes, and he considers that the art.
Mm-hmm. What about the gerbils?
Well, Professor Negroponte, I think, is in a different category. He's a professor of architecture, I think, with strong aesthetic sensibilities. I've read one of his books on computer technology. And I think that perhaps of all the people in the country, he's one of the, 25 interested in computers and using them with human beings in a compatible and honest sense. He's, in fact, that's what the whole program at MIT that he's involved in is about.
Wouldn't you say, or it seems to me, that it might have to do really with the studying behaviorist psychology rather than with the study of art or the creation of art?
Well, of course, that's a debatable and very real point of view, whether mice or any other animals simulate the habit patterns of human beings. But since we don't have computers that can monitor or control or invade in any way human environments, animals are used.
Presumably, this experiment would have a direct connection with art through architecture. We might, in planning our architecture for the future, in devising plans for the use of modules, be guided by the responses of the gerbils, might we not?
I think this is what Negroponte actually has in mind, ultimately.
What do you think of such a work in the art as Hans Hacke's thing, which he calls News, I think? And it's a setup of 5 teletype machines, exactly as I've seen in newspaper offices all my life, spilling out the copy as it comes in over the wire services. The work of art is this bank of teletype machines and the copy rolling over on the floor. Do you see that as a work of art?
Well, actually, the concept of the ready-made or the manufactured object has been with us for a long time, since 1914 with Marcel Duchamp. But I think what Hacke is trying to do is to go use the ready-made, but go one step further. What he's actually saying is that here is a ready-made in which parts of it are coming into existence all the time. In other words, the news is being produced at a steady rate, you know, pouring out onto the floor. And I've noticed that many visitors read the news reports. Of course, an interesting aspect of this piece is that all the news reports are somewhat different, even when they're reporting on the same topic.
Professor Burnham, how would you define a work of art or the art experience? Surely as a professor at Northwestern, that question has been asked of you, or in your books. Have you not had to deal with it?
I think there are definitions of works of art. Most of them are practical definitions or functional definitions. They're not, as you know, there probably isn't any absolute definition of a work of art.
What is yours? Do you have one?
I have a book coming out in 2 months, and I'll stick my neck out and say that my definition of a work of art is any activity done by an artist which follows the particular logic structure set up by our society for the production of art.
I would gather then that your interest in, or at least the emphasis on the new technology, does not negate the value of art of the past in any sense. They too were created in response to needs.
Exactly. In no way does this show try to jeopardize or push away the art of the past. What we're saying is that art is a very considerable subject, and we're touching on just one ramification of it, perhaps new in its potential, but just one.
But you have said that an artist had to make it. The men who installed the teletype machines in my newspaper offices were not artists. What is the difference? What makes one a work of art and the other a utilitarian act without which we couldn't operate?
Well, as Duchamp said many years ago, he chose the object. And as you know today, there are many works of art that are produced by factories or produced by other individuals besides the artist. Somehow, it is the artist choosing the work and putting it in an art context and structuring it in a way in which viewers can react or respond to it. That makes the art, not the actual manufacture of the object.
You talk about the artist structuring it and selecting it, but what about that work in the exhibition called Conversationalist, where it's the visitor, really, who's making the contribution? Let me tell readers what it's about. It's a series of three rooms, in the first of which the visitor is given several words, perhaps five, which he's to incorporate in a little essay he thinks about, a story. In the second one, he recites the story, and in the third room, here's a playback of his story, and stories are created by the people who preceded him in the exhibition. Why is that a work of art, then? The artist, in this case Anton, hasn't really done anything except come up with a gimmick. It's the visitor, who is not an artist, who is creating it.
Well, perhaps this is where Anton has a philosophical bone to pick with the art world. As far as we know, the art tradition, the Western art tradition, has said that the work of art is more or less a given object, and the viewer is passive, and that it's a one-way kind of conversation, simply the viewer looking at the object. What Anton is trying to do is to structure a situation in which people enter into, say, an art context by juxtaposing the same words that they use in a story with what same words used by other people in different stories. In other words, he's saying the art is the situation, not an object or not a one-way process.
But in that case, then anyone at all can qualify as an artist, according to your definition.
Well, one of the things that I repeat in my essay is something that an MIT professor said to me. He said, we have machines today that interact at an extremely high level with intelligent people. We have the same machines interacting with dull people, and they produce terrible and uninteresting conversations or feedback.
Except I'd rather not talk with any machine, and as I told Adam at the show yesterday, I'd much rather have a conversation with him or listen to a conversation between him and you, say, than with passers-by of no particular background at all. Thank you very much, Mr. Burnham, for coming to tell us about the exhibition at the Jewish Museum called Software, which opens this evening.
Thank you, Emily Jenauer. And that concludes Newsfront for tonight, our subjects ranging from the conditions on the nation's campuses, the economic struggle between East and West, the fate of a Marine Lance Corporal accused of rape in Okinawa, and most recently, the latest at the Jewish Museum, a kind of mechanistic look at modern art. Tomorrow evening here on Newsfront, one of our guests will be the newly elected president of the United Nations General Assembly, Ambassador Edvard Humbro of Norway.
I'm Mitchell Krause. We invite you to join us again tomorrow night at 10. Until then, good night and stay tuned for the latest in the replay of President Nixon's address earlier today at Kansas State University.
NewsFront is supported in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.